From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues. I'm Karina.
And I am Chiara.
And in this episode, we'll be exploring the role memory plays in urban resilience. And by the word memory, we embrace its various understandings, from processes, norms, rituals of remembrance, to the challenges that the shifting baseline syndrome of climate adaptation presents us with, where our perceptions of change are out of sync with the actual changes taking place around us.
To explore this all with us, we're joined by Cristobal Rebecco. Cristobal works as a PhD student at the Climate Service Center Germany. His research focuses on knowledge transfer for local resilience building, particularly for risk reduction at the municipal level. Previously, Cristobal worked as senior advisor in several projects on climate change adaptation in Latin America, focusing on the role of local governments and planning for climate action. Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues.
Chiara, Corina, thank you very much for your invitation. I feel honored to be here tonight.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. Could you tell us a bit more about what led you to work in the field of urban resilience?
Where did it all start? I remember the first time I did field work. That was for my undergrad, for my bachelor degree. And I ended up working in the North Burkina Faso on a local, very small municipality. And everything seemed to be related to what the mayor and the local government would do and organize. Everything was pretty much dependent on that. I wasn't an urban planner by studies. I did development studies. But when I started working with that governance level, then I got really intrigued to see how much it could be done at the local level. Then, of course, growing up in a city like Santiago de Chile, which is a big city with many complex problems, then the idea of urban resilience came up as a very inspiring aspect of how to integrate development, decision-making, and all this local complexity. And the local level and at the urban level specifically, it display a lot of these challenges that for me were very intriguing and fascinating.
Your background is very interesting. In your work, what role does memory play?
When you contacted me a few weeks ago, I really had to think about it because it's not something that you or I personally would have seen explicitly in a lot of the work I come across with, especially in urban resilience. I centrally believe it is a central core aspect of understanding what the past has meant, and without understanding the past, of course, we cannot understand the future. And for me, it's something that's very striking is about understanding when you read a lot about urban resilience, it normally brings this urban component as a technical description of cities. And you come across two definitions of cities as complex artificial environments that are very complex, where you have large populations and assets. And at some point, I had the feeling that we're missing the social aspect beyond understanding that people are agents, but are agents with memory. And that memory for me was very important to explore in my current research for my PhD. I've come across to some bodies of literature that to me are very important. And the first one is really understanding that in order to understand urban resilience, we have to understand the role of values, knowledge, cultures, and institutions. And memory is a central aspect of all this whole subjective aspects in decision-making. Memory, in a sense, the way I see it in a more emotional level, which is a very important aspect, and I would like to connect that in a minute with urban resilience, is what Eduardo Galeano in his book, The Book of Hugs, El Libro de los Abrazos, mentions of the word in Spanish, memory, recordar. And he refers to the word recordis, cordis from the Latin heart. And recordis means to circulate things through the heart again. And normally you circulate things through your heart again because those things have marked you and they're important to you. And through the exercise of recordis, What we're reminding is what's important for us, either in a positive or a negative perspective. Because to remember is an exercise that is full of emotion, and either you experience or display aspects of your identity as you record, as you remember, because you bring things that somehow are appealing to you. In that sense, I think that connecting the idea of memory to cities, we have to make a distinction between what's important in terms of the technical aspects of, in this case, resilience and climate change adaptation in urban areas, versus the actual adaptive challenge, which is something coined by Karen O'Brien, who work extensively working on local governance. She talks about our ability as humans to develop solutions to technical problems. And in that sense, people working in urban resilience tend to have this very optimistic view about technicalities, architects, urban planners, etc., being able to tackle climate change and resilience problems. The problem of resilience in urban areas, I believe, is better portrayed by this sense of transformation. I mean, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do and try to incorporate in resilience is this idea of long-lasting, permanent adaptation, change, innovation, something that requires a deeper understanding of how things change in society at the end of the day. In that context, O'Brien mentions that adaptive challenges are very uncomfortable and often conflictual conditions or situations that demand changing mindsets, priorities, values. And that's why this transformation aspect of resilience is a lot more complex than just pure technical solutions. What's the role of memory on that transformation? Well, remembering what's important is not, first of all, socially or politically neutral when we talk about it as a society, collectively. What we remember is selective. And when it comes down to the collective memory, there are some groups, elites, that have the power to highlight what's important versus what is not. We need to understand that the challenges of this transformation are related to values. And these values, at the end of the day, condition what we as a society think that is worth maintaining in our memory. And in that sense, we cannot simply ignore the fact that memory is selective and it's a very politically charged concept. I think that another aspect that I'm very interested about from the idea of memory, I'm also using a lot of the work of Yasanov and Wollstone, who talk about these ideas of how can we imagine the future, how can we recall stories from the past to really think about our reality. And in that sense, designing our model of reality is very important that we consider what set of beliefs and assumptions and attitudes and values become part of that construction. Because at the end of the day, the way we perceive reality influences basically all the aspects of our life and how we can describe problems and think about resilience.
Although the definitions of urban resilience vary, one repetitive pattern is the notion of proactive adaptation, the recovery from a shock or stress. We feel that memory can play a role in urban resilience because it shapes our identity, our life, and the way we connect in cities. You said memory is selective, and governments, local authorities, they can play a role in shaping this memory. How do you connect the notion of functional memory to institutional memory? What are we going to keep and why? How can we use it to build resilience?
Can I respond to you through a little story? So this is the story about a boy who grew up in an urban city in the south of the world, very much in the south of the world, during the 80s. One of the things that I learned from growing up in Santiago, probably many of the people who grew up during the 80s in the big cities of South America, experienced what really means to grow up in dictatorship in a city. And I always thought when I was a child that a dictatorship, for me, I mean, the way I experienced dictatorship when I was a child was when my mom would call me in when I was playing football with my friends on the street because there were tear gas all over the place. So you had to basically run back home and close the windows and stay there until the tear gas would dissipate, because we used to live close to the Faculty of Sociology at the University of Chile, which is one of the most, back in the day, it was a very controversial place because all the critical thinking against the dictatorship would take place there. You can study pedagogy there. They used to call it piedragógico, piedra from stone, because stones would fly there and back all the time between students and the police. So it was a very a very interesting place. And I happened to basically grow up 20 meters away from that university. So that was a very active environment back in the 80s. And the first time I really wondered about the role of memory was when I was a bit older at primary school. And the new director of our school was an appointed military servant. So there wasn't the good old traditional director. Someone had studied pedagogy, but there was a military servant. And in our first history class, history was only taught up until the year 1971. Anything that happened afterwards, so there was a coup d'etat in 1973, was not taught at high school, not at primary school. In fact, you were not allowed to mention the words Allende, who was the overthrown president. And normally we would tend to learn stuff about the Spaniards getting to Latin America and kind of with this attitude towards downgrading indigenous communities. I mean, not to mention indigenous knowledge. I mean, that was not part of any agenda back in the days, at least not in those settings. But what I found, that the changing architecture of a city during dictatorship and the role of that in memory. So the story I want to tell you is about the poor. And the poor communities in Santiago, they were dumped on the periphery of the city. And I use the word dump because there were literally 100 families that were living in this campamentos, very informal settlements, were literally sent and dumped on old dumping sites, vertederos. So entire families with children and, young families and old people were just sent to the outskirts of Santiago, and they were indicated that the new living area was going to be on a dumping site. So families had to demarcate the lines to indicate where the future roads would eventually be constructed, where the piping system would run. Families had to organize themselves around communal cooking pots. No services existed in these areas, of course. And you were advised not to smoke a cigarette because given that there were gases emerging from the dump site, then you could literally explode. And indeed, people did explode. So that's why you were advised not to smoke a cigarette in the area. But beyond that, people were segregated in that way because the new city was meant to host the rich economic development based on extractive industries. And you would see a part of the city where very rich people would live on the same living standards that you would find nowadays in Oslo, Norway, for example. There was a new financial center built lately that people probably call the Sanhattan, as I mentioned, the Manhattan. And there was a wave of large avenues with exotic trees and that were built just to serve that purpose. So in fact, there was a highway that connected through the underground, the international airport, directly with the rich area. So the rich would just drive underground and get directly to the airport. And of course, municipalities would not have much funding to do many improvements because the municipal coffers depended on the local businesses and the patents, which of course in poor areas were not too impressive beyond the usual corner shop versus all the corporations that pay patents in the rich areas of the city. There was, for example, an area called Bajos de Mena that hosts about less than 1 million people, but I think it's about 600,000 people nowadays. And the only service they have is just basically one pharmacy and a small police unit with two police officials, which are not too popular in the local area, by the way. I could just go on and on to describe the absurdity of this situation. And I use the word absurd because I don't think that there are many more ways to call this purposefully designed system of injustice. And the city of Santiago nowadays is just a material expression of that injustice. And I think today this is the reality that seems to have been there forever. It is difficult to imagine that at some point things were different. Somehow the elites managed to impose a dominant economic, political system of capitalism and neoliberalism that seems to be the only way forward. And that is when memory comes so importantly into the thinking and decision-making. Can we imagine a new resilient future if the basic components of our memory have been programmed in such a way that injustice becomes the normal? I think that for me is a crucial question, because nowadays memory is not just about thinking about good or bad experiences. It's about understanding what the system of injustice in the world, as it manifests in cities, has programmed people to think what's possible, to think what's possible to dream about in the future. And I go back to Guston's work, who talks about the right to think about the future. And I would like here to quote Jasanoff, and she says that the ways in which we know and represent the world are inseparable from the ways in which we choose to live in it. We need to represent that world. Memory is central. We cannot divide memory from our capacity to imagine and to decide how to look forward. So if everything we know emerges from injustice, segregation, how can we design a resilient city based on a collective imaginary? Can we imagine that city? Perhaps one of the most problematic questions we intend to address is to imagine what the resilient city is about. Not only what it looks like, because I think that clever architects and urban designers have already proposed very sophisticated models that make a lot of sense. But is that possible for everyone and everyone? Is that new city going to be compatible with the value systems and worldviews of the majority? Or is it going to just reproduce inequalities? And I think that there are several examples that show how improving parts of the city increase gentrification, for example. So the resilient city, it can be only based on a sense of void legitimacy, and constructing that demands good memory. Imagining how we're going to change values, beliefs, worldviews is just a very complex task, and the role of memory there is central. So we cannot forget, and the systems that help us to forget are systems that are part of the barriers to reach that urban resilience that we discuss from either technical or moral or more philosophical perspectives.
So much resonated from my own past of growing up in a post-communist city that was really, really desperately trying to figure out what does life look like in a post-socialist, post-communist world. Thinking back of that time, I think it's really interesting. And, you know, as a child, as a teenager, I didn't quite understand it. But it's really interesting to also kind of note the strategic and systematic ways in which memory was being erased, the tangible and the intangible memory as well. And interestingly, we were never taught in school. Communism was not something that was discussed. History kind of stopped for us just after World War II. And I kind of wonder, you know, like there's this, maybe we also need to have a bit of distance from the past to be able to really interrogate that memory. But I'm also wondering, what does that mean for the challenges of today as well? You know, like even just the memory of this year, we need to make sense of the recent past much more quickly to figure out how do we adapt. And I think this quite nicely segues into our next aspect of memory that we want to explore, which is this concept of radical remembering. So this is something that was put forward by a poet, the poet Jake Skeets, and he talks about the radical remembering as a way to build our collective memory, almost like going beyond just the, you know, the perfunctory remembrance of a disaster, of a historical event. And we also have scientific approaches to that as well. So for example, the Stockholm Resilience Institute talks about the role of memory carriers. So whether they're artifacts, whether they're traditions, rituals, stories in helping us build resilience. And, you know, sometimes they can be tangible and also used to propagandistic motives. So you have, you know, like memorial architecture, but also sometimes they can be less so. And an example that came to our minds was the plaque that marked the first glacier that was lost to the climate crisis, Öxarkull, which was unveiled in 2019 in Iceland. My sort of question to you would be, how do we tackle this? Like, how do we build this radical remembering as a way to tackle the fact that our perception of change is perhaps out of kilter with the scale and the pace of change happening around us? And this is where, you know, that term of the shifting baseline might come handy. I don't know what your thoughts on this might be.
I think it's a very important and difficult question, because it's about understanding. Again, I try to always go back to this idea of how we represent the past through material entities. And I think that the city is the reflection of that. How do we track change? How we understand change? How do we propose a direction to change? One of the things that, for example, when you were mentioning the idea of memory over disasters, for example, and social natural catastrophes, for instance, we have plenty of those in Chile with earthquakes and landslides. And it turned out that it's not that people don't remember, that it's not advisable to establish your house in a risk-prone area. It's about the options that people sometimes just do not have the option to use their memory and their experience to make decisions. And I think that it's important to mark events in life that can teach us how to move forward as a society. And I think that the example you bring about the disappearing glacier in Iceland, I think it's crucial, because it tells us that there was something there before and it's not there anymore. But for me, the question is beyond the emotional sensation that we feel that we're missing, we're losing things that are important. But how do we take that and use it as a resource for action for the future? And that's where I get really puzzled with the concept of memory versus the possibilities to decide as to how to use that memory and experience. Experience, of course, our knowledgeable experience that we learn, we reflect upon, we know what's important, we use our value system, we try to make a collective idea of what's important in society. But most of the times we might lack, and this is from the research I'm bringing to my PhD at the moment, understanding how is it that experiential knowledge, that experience, can be really turned into a resource for doing things differently. It's not just about the emotions. It's not only about understanding what's the right course of things towards the future. It is also about possibilities. It is about skills, resources that have to be in place so that you can bring your agency, learn from that experience, bring that memory into action, activate that memory. Activating memory, I think, is so difficult. Memory is not only about thoughts about the past or experience. It is also about capacity to activate that so that we can change the course of action for the future.
Completely. And I think what comes to your mind is also, if we're seeking to activate memory, then also trying to understand what might be the barriers to this that you were kind of hinting at. And connected to this, there was a study done in 2017 by Gard Hansen and all about responses to flood resilience. And in their studies, they were looking at the connection between the underlying drivers that kind of support an urge to forget. So, you know, and you kind of see it today as well, the urge to move on, to go back to normal, to go back to business as usual, to get back on track, like even just these like linguistic phrases. But actually, if these drivers are the ones that shape the responses, then actually it means that the resulting resilience is very low. And I think this study is very interesting in building this connection between actually how do you build resilience to something like a flood versus not having that time to really kind of understand what happened, what were the consequences, what might this mean that we'll do differently next time, and how do we build this adaptive capacity? What might this mean for how we better understand risk, how we navigate this tension between the types of recovery that are desirable, which is, of course, very contested. And also, we can really see it at play with COVID. Like, I don't really want to make COVID the centerpiece, but it's very hard to not draw parallels between the underlying economic drivers and the way they pose barriers to actually build our capacity to remember, but also to activate that memory in the ways that you were talking about it.
A proxy example, a parallel example, just to make the case. After the dictatorship, there was a very painful period that kicked off after 15 years. So I'm talking about early 2000s. That the victims of human rights abuses were finally going through the process of telling their stories, what happened to them during those years in jail or concentration camps in Chile. And it was a very crucial moment in our history, because not only many things about the truth, about the past of what happened, emerged and in a way brought new input to society to understand why this, as the Germans put it, should never happen again. But that process had to be supported. That process was not, I wouldn't even say, I don't want to use the word voluntaristic, but people had to really be interrogated, asked, supported by psychologists and a whole network of a safety net where they could provide that level of very crude and rough information of what had happened to them. I think that we humans tend to avoid thinking about difficult moments of the past because it's not easy. It takes a lot of energy of us. It's painful. It's difficult. It questions a lot of things that we consider are important for us. So it's not an easy process. It's like a catharsis that you have to go through. And I have the feeling that learning from bad experiences in urban resilience is a lot about understanding what this hardship means for other people. And that is probably even more difficult when you have not experienced that, because it is about putting yourself in someone else's shoes. It is about fully understanding what it means for those people. I think that learning from those difficult experiences from the past, and I bring that to urban resilience now, I think that we might need special methods, resources, support, because voluntaristically, unless it is something that is keeping you in hardship nowadays, I doubt that many people will be able to look back on that and draw best lessons.
Indeed, memory is often painful. Let's dig into this notion of looking back to look forward. The challenge here is that we hear everyone talking about unprecedented times. When we talk about the different climate events, for example, it's always worse than before. As society evolves, so do the risks, right? We sometimes forget that when we come up with a new technology, sure, it leads to a lot of rewards, but also new risks. How might we leverage memory to navigate both the known and the unknown?
So one of the tricky questions about lessons learned and best practices so that we can use those for the future is that, because I use practice theory as a core aspect of my research, for me it's very difficult to talk about best practices, because situational analysis tells you that practices occur in specific situations. You might learn best methods that you can transfer. You might learn good methodologies that make sense. They can orient your context. But it is a lot more complicated than just saying, well, this is how it works here, therefore we do it. Because even if it does work, the way that practice evolves after that is completely situated, right? So theory on the side. I think that what we can learn from the past to orient the future is, the way I see it, is about learning methods, processes, step by step, always with the openness to understand that the way we configure that experience into our context is going to be a new result. It's going to be a new output out of what we do. So in terms of navigating the unknown, we only have the past. I mean, we cannot, even if we try to invent all the, anything you can think of, any mechanisms, technology, whatever, we don't know the future. We don't have to know the future because we know enough to understand that we are navigating very troublesome waters and that we are on the edge of many of the planetary boundaries and that our cities demand changes. And I think that all the urban challenges and resilience is not about not knowing what to do. The way I see it is how to do it. That's for me the main question because, for example, today I got this email from the new Leipzig Charter on Sustainable European Cities that was updated and released today. They talk about the dimensions for action in order to achieve resilient cities, and they talk about the just city, the green city, the productive city, urban policy for the common good, integrated approach, co-creation, multi-level governance, place-based approach. I mean, you have it all. I mean, I could keep with a long list of keywords and buzzwords and concepts and democracy, participation, integration, fairness, equity, governance, you name it. Maybe not all, but we know more or less that we can agree at least that we want to make a better world by playing within these buzzwords. But it's more complicated than that because there is a system design. And here I might take my governance view on the problem that this is the problems that we experience nowadays are not just randomly the result of people's good intentions that oops suddenly down the line got kind of like mixed up with things that were completely unexpected. Their interests, their agendas, their vested interests in how cities have been designed. Cities, going back to example I put before from Santiago, are material representations of our times or the times before. But there is a specific setup in the city that responds either to governmental decisions, the way we implement public institutions and the way we lead public institutions, and private interests and the elites. And there are reasons why cities respond in those contexts. It's not just about the logic of creating a more integrated city. Public transport, you might want to turn all the public transport green and create better avenues for bicycles and make it all green again. But at the end of the day, you're circulating people where the centers of decision-making are placed, where the center of businesses are placed, where the services are placed. So you cannot think about urban mobility, sustainable mobility, without thinking about the redistribution. Interesting question for me now in the context of COVID. How is that new distribution going to take place? Well, surprise, we see the big getting bigger, the Amazon bigs, the Amazon folks, the Zoom folks, every big players. It's a reformulation of the elite. Power is shifting. For me, the idea of power in this sense is not any other than the power to impose what's meaningful. Power in terms of what's meaningful to remember, what's meaningful to take from that past and bring it for the future as an ingredient for our thinking about the future. We cannot forget that this is about a technical, but it is also about the problem of governance. And it is also about the problem of ethics in how we think about the city. So going back to the question, it isn't about not knowing what's important for the future. I think it is about coming down to terms with the fact that we have to negotiate and that negotiation is not easy. And we see it in all around the world nowadays. It seems that the negotiation table is kind of fed up with unfulfilled promises. And you see revolts in all over the world right now. And that for me is very worrying because despite the fact that we might see new directions in how decisions are made, it also talks a lot about how the past brought us into this and who's going to be able to select what's important for the future. We go back to Rustem. Who has the right to decide what's important in greening for the future? Who has the right to think about the future, to imagine the future? I think that we are in that very same battle right now, trying to decide who's got the right to decide about that future.
The question that you have ended with is a really powerful one, and I think it's one that I'm hoping to explore throughout the whole arc of this podcast series of actually how can we sharpen our attention, even to where some of these words are used. Even that, as a process of noticing and observing, can be a powerful start to then start saying, well, what do we do about it? So we might not solve issues regarding memory in this episode, but I think it's really important to just bring our attention to it for a moment. Just ask ourselves some reflective questions. With that, I want to say a huge thank you, Cristobal, for joining us in the opening episode.
Thank you, Cristobal, for exploring with us some of the numerous links between memory and urban resilience.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com, or you can tweet us with the hashtag URDialogues. Chat to you soon.